Tomorrow marks a year since a high-rise fire claimed the lives of four residents of the Marco Polo building: Brett Reller, his mother Melba Dilley, Joanne Kawata, and Marilyn Van Giesen. Lawyers, in filing suit against the management company, the Association of Apartment Owners, and the company Ohana Control Systems, created a nonprofit company on behalf of the deceased victims. Reverend Phil Reller, who lost his brother and mother in the fire, talked about why he pushed to create the Kokua Community Kokua Foundation for Fire Safety.
On the year anniversary, we want to remember our loved ones, but also not just the tragedy that happened to our families, but the hundreds of families whose lives were disrupted and disordered at Marco Polo. And so we're here to remember them and hopefully to look for accountability and for solutions, because this is a community issue. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent Hawaii citizens who live in condo towers where inadequate life safety and fire safety mechanisms and processes are still in place. So as a community, we need to come together and find ways to prevent such needless and preventative tragedies from happening. We want something good to come out of this tragedy, simply put. And we've created this Community Kokua Foundation for fire safety and recovery. We've met with numerous agencies on Oahu, like the Red Cross, Community Assets, retired firefighters and first responders, to have ask them what's missing, what do we need to help and assist people either get fire safety equipment or to help people who have gone through the crisis afterwards. And what we found from their advice is that there seems to be two areas of primary concern that's missing in the structures that we have in place now. One is primary education for schools, for churches, for civic groups, etc. American Red Cross has programs like that, and perhaps we can partner with them to do that. And the second thing is, when there is a crisis, Marco Polo is such a good example of this. There's an immediate availability of crisis management. But as the weeks turn into months, and the months turns in now to a year, and residents have been, you know, shuffled from hotel to hotel or whatever, and still don't know if they have a toothbrush or a sofa in their apartments, there needs to be ongoing support for that. That's the recovery dimension. We're putting together an advisory board. We want to be partners with other agencies on Oahu and maybe through the state to assist with fire safety and recovery issues. We're so appreciative of the mayor and our council's response to this. The broader issue, however, is not sprinklers. The broader issue is elevators that didn't work, alarm systems that didn't work, violations of codes that go back 100 years in this country, that were known, that were at least on three separate occasions, the fire department itself gave directives to Marco Polo to make those things change, and those recommendations were ignored. So it's really about the greedy choices that were made, and when someone comes in and says, I'm an advisor to you, and doesn't advise you that you have just put 1,000 people's lives at risk by your inaction, I wonder about that greedy choice too.
You say because they didn't put these safety measures in, they saved a lot of money. Do we know how much?
And no. But I do understand that after they said, as parts of their defense or arguments to the public, that this is going to cost our residents too much money, particularly our senior citizens, et cetera, and so that's prohibitive to us. When they did pass the resolution to do that, they found the money in their coffers. They found the money in their reserves to do that. Too late for my mother and my brother. We had a number of memorial services across the country for my brother. Philadelphia, Detroit, L.A., New York, because he was really deeply loved in his Hawaiian Airlines. Had a couple of memorial services, and they've created a garden downstairs in his memory. He was just deeply loved. So we just had committed the ashes of my mother and my brother to our family cemetery in Minnesota. And that brought a certain amount of closure. By far the hardest thing for me, and I've said this, is when those memories come of their last half hour and their last hour of life. I actually saw Marilyn, Mrs. Van Giesen, being wheeled down a couple hours after the fire hit its zenith up there, coughing and wheezing and trying to just get breath. I wanted to run to her because it was so dreadful to see. Mike and I go back about 25 years. So those memories come back, and I have dreams about that. I have dreams about not... I was down there watching the fire spread. Those memories aren't going to go away. The sadness isn't going to go away. But we can do something so that this doesn't happen to other families who are vulnerable and at risk today on Oahu and throughout the state. And really, it's a national issue because of greedy choices that management companies and associations make to save money.
Is there anything else you want to add just about the firefighters?
Oh, my gosh.
That place?
You know, that's a whole other issue, is that because of greedy choices that prevent people from doing adequate life and fire safety mechanisms, these first responders are called to go into places that people haven't prepared, and they put their lives at danger. I've shared this story a number of times, but for some reason they weren't able to get that command unit there, but they had a whiteboard where there was a firefighter putting names of people. I went to him, I said, there's two people alive in 2613. He put their names at the top of the list, said, we'll try to get to them. When I was informed by the chaplain that they had died, I walked back over there. He runs up to me, the firefighter, sweating, smoky, throws his arms around me and says he's so sorry. He feels bad. I said, well, it's a good thing you didn't tell me because you had another victim here. That didn't end there. He came to my house 2 days later, 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, said I really couldn't sleep very well. I just want you to know our support. He gets out of his motorcycle, he comes running up to me and throws his arms around me. That's who these first responders are. They put their lives at risk because of greedy choices that other people make. And I have nothing but respect for what they did in this case.
That fire caused more than $100 million in damages, and to this day, many residents in the top floors are still displaced. The cause of the blaze is so far still undetermined, though investigators for the lawyers and the insurance companies are still looking for answers.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum presenting Unreal, Hawaii and Popular Imagination, an exhibit that sets up a conversation about Hawaii as depicted in archival commercial art versus contemporary reality. Opens tomorrow.
On July 21st, Hawaii Symphony violinist Nancy Shoup Wu, Hoku award-winning violinist Dwayne Padilla, and classical guitarist Ian O'Sullivan bring their formidable Yale training to HPR's Atherton Studio. They call themselves Eli 3.0. Reserve your seats at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, promoting health and reducing harm for people with HIV infection. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa, Ulehua, Unihau, Ukaua, Oahu. Ave o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we look at a fixture of Honolulu's downtown, heralded the pride of the Pacific in a 1922 San Francisco newspaper headline. The Hawaii Theater stands proudly as the last of Hawaii's historic theaters. Operated initially by the Consolidated Amusement Company, the theater was considered the most opulent in the islands and indeed in the whole of the Pacific. Designed by architects Walter Emery and Marshall Webb, the stately theater draws on Byzantine, Corinthian, and Moorish architectural styles, with an interior no less lavish than its exterior. Inside, a gilded dome presides over an imposing marble columns, silk curtains, and a myriad of art pieces. While initially a hub for vaudeville performances and silent movies, the theater became one of downtown's premier cinemas with the advent of sound and color film. For today's Backyard Quiz, when was the Hawaii Theater built? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew's Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
HIV and AIDS may no longer dominate the headlines, but more than 2,500 people in Hawaii deal with it and its stigma every day. The newly formed Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center has as its mission reducing harm, promoting health, creating wellness, and fighting stigma in Hawaii and the Pacific. Its executive director, Heather Lusk, is with us in our studio. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is a new organization formed of two existing organizations. Tell me about that.
Yes. So the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center, which launched July 1st, is combined from two organizations, the Life Foundation, which is 35 years old and the largest and oldest HIV organization in the Pacific, mm-hmm. and the CHOW Project, which stands for Community Health Outreach Work, which is a 30-year-old agency dedicated to statewide outreach, harm reduction, and runs our statewide syringe exchange program.
I'm figuring that in the past, their missions pretty much overlapped.
Yes, and in fact, ironically, syringe exchange started at the Life Foundation over 35 years ago, then CHOW came along, so they're kind of coming back full circle to combine. We've been co-located for about 7 years and collaborating, so our joke is that we live together and now we're married.
Well, many happy returns.
Thank you. Right?
But it's an increasingly difficult situation that you folks face, and it's not, as I said in the lead, HIV and AIDS aren't at the top of the news anymore. It's not a new crisis, right?
Right. Why it's not a new crisis and we have medications that can basically manage HIV. It's really a chronic, manageable disease. The reality is in Hawaii, we still have many people who don't know they have the disease or don't have access to the life-saving treatments they need. So that's a big focus of our work, is to address the homelessness, the substance use, the mental health issues of our whole community, but then using that to leverage and supporting people with HIV in a kind of whole comprehensive approach.
Because an enormous overlap between homelessness, opioid addiction, HIV, and just living in, you know, a lot of HIV is transmitted through needles, right?
Exactly. So because of the statewide syringe exchange that started here in Hawaii in 89, we were the first state to have statewide syringe access. We have lower HIV rates than many of the states on the continent, but that doesn't mean it doesn't still happen. And particularly our folks with HIV now have a lot more other issues, such as I mentioned, homelessness, substance use, mental health. And then we've broadened beyond HIV because we now have street-based based outreach for homelessness, a substance use outreach. We have a street based wound care and now a clinic in our office for wound care. So we're trying to use a kind of no wrong door approach to be able to get folks into the care they need and then address a multitude of issues.
What's it like out on the street these days?
Oh, Chris, it's, as folks know, homelessness is a very complex issue, and therefore we need really kind of complex multi-sector responses to homelessness. I will admit that as we've done a big success in getting folks off the street with Housing First, it's also led to, we believe, some instability because we've kind of worked with the folks that we were able to more easily connect to services, and who's still on the street, they often have many more reasons why they're still out there. And that has led, we have seen, to unfortunately some increased kind of chaos and even violence. So we're partnering right now, honestly, with HPD and other public safety folks to do more public health, public safety outreach. So on Wednesday night, you may have heard that a group of folks went out with HPD and 23 people were able to get into housing because they could go do outreach in places they may not normally be able to because they had HPD there for the safety part. So I think we're looking at unique partnerships to be able to address this in multitude ways.
Is there housing available and people out on the street who could be in that housing but aren't, or is there just no
room at the end? So one thing we do for these coordinated outreach is we get a shelter vacancy count so that we know exactly how many spots, and we used kind of all 23 open slots on the island the other night. Mm-hmm. But honestly, Chris, we have 3,000 people on what's called the by name list. So these are 3,000 people that are homeless that our outreach workers across all of the agencies, they know them, they're ready, they've been assessed, they're document ready, but there's no housing for them to go into. So honestly, we have more of a housing crisis than a homelessness crisis. We don't have the inventory to put people, even when they're ready, willing, and able, into housing. We have 3,000 on Oahu ready, and we don't have the spaces for them. So our systems are coordinating better. We're working with city, state, and our community partners better. But as you know, it's still a big issue out there.
Well, that's 3,000 documented.
Right. Not even counting those that aren't documented, exactly.
One of the criticisms that's been advanced of the point-in-time count is that a lot of people chronically homeless, the last thing they want is somebody coming toward them with a clipboard asking them for personal information. Is that fair to say?
No, I think that is fair to say. And in order to get into the list for housing, you have to be willing to share some information about yourself. And so that's what our outreach workers do every day, is build rapport and go out there and be consistent. We just got someone who's been 30 years on the street, got them into housing because it took years of relationship building. But when they were ready, the outreach worker was there to do that, what we call warm handoff to that next level. But it's constant building, and then working with our business community, we know they're very frustrated with what they see as lack of progress. So we're really hoping that we can continue to build upon the successes we've seen over the past couple of years.
A lot of the people that the frustrated business owners you just alluded to might see are those who are pretty far gone and not likely to be, filling out forms and, able to get a job and chronically, because now we're talking about the intersection of homelessness and mental illness.
Exactly, Chris, with mental illness. And as we were discussing earlier, our criminal justice system is unfortunately somewhat of our de facto mental health system. We don't have community mental health, particularly residential mental health services, unless you're involved in the criminal justice system. So there's really very few options for these folks who don't even have the capacity to make the decisions that they would need to do to get into the housing.
Is that a growing number? The off-the-books homeless?
Yes. At least the data that we've seen, there's a lot of focus on mental illness this year. I don't know if you've heard of assisted community treatment, which is trying to make it easier for folks that are working with those with mental illness to get a court order so they can get access to treatment. There's more and more focus. So this year, I'm part of Partners in Care. I'm the vice chair. That's our homeless coalition. And we're about to apply for our big $10 million from HUD for the island. And there's a focus this year on the chronically homeless with mental illness. That's who we're going to really try to focus on for that application.
You know, Heather, there's so many brick walls that you hit in the work that you do. What keeps you, how do you hang on to optimism?
Yeah. I'll be honest, for me, it's the staff of the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center. We are rooted in six core values of compassion, respect, advocacy, quality care, harm reduction and integrity. And the staff really reflect that, not just in the way they develop services, but in the way we treat each other. We're really a sanctuary, not just for those struggling with mental illness, homelessness, substance use, and HIV, but I want to also create the center also be that sanctuary for the staff, because they're out in the streets doing incredible work. They see so much trauma every day. So I think together we try to highlight the light in someone. And I know that sounds a little bit cheesy, but we really are looking at a strength-based model of where's our strength, where's our community resilient, where are they doing well, and how can we build on that instead of focusing on the hard part.
Well, the community clearly needs your strength, Heather. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And if you want to know more, please visit www.hhhrc.org.
Heather Lusk is the executive director of the new organization with combined services called the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center, created from a merger of the Life Foundation and the community health outreach work, our CHOW project. You can learn more about it and its mission on our conversation Facebook page. Long before Election Day, people and organizations in Hawaii signal their support for candidates by voting with their pocketbooks. And in politics, you can never go wrong by following the money. The Campaign Spending Commission's numbers are in for races across the state, and reporter Nathan Eagle takes a look at them in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
The first question is obviously going to be the governor's race. Who's got the money? How are they spending it? Who's got more?
Well, Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa came out firing. She raised more. She spent more, about $1.4 million to be exact, than her opponent, Governor David Ige, who's trying to get around to having another term. But he has twice as much money left on hand. He's got about 600 some thousand to her 300 or so thousand. So it'll be fun to watch this last month until the August 11th primary.
For a lot of campaigns, the mantra is that you save your fire for that last month because people aren't really paying attention, and then that's when you do your ad buy. It sounds as if that might be Ige's strategy.
Well, you're absolutely right, and it does come down to strategy. You've got to get people aware that the race is happening, aware that you're running again, but then not too soon, right? Because then they'll just forget or lose interest or get maybe even just tired of your ads. So I do suspect we're going to see a blitz of ads here in these next few weeks.
Do you think there's a greater awareness of the governor's office than we have had at past gubernatorial primaries, you know, just because of issues that have been raised, post-missile alert, for example?
You know, I think it's similar. I do. We've got two candidates that are pretty well known running for this office. So I think it's kind of on par.
Now we're thinking about the lieutenant governor's office, which is interesting if for no other reason in terms of how many people are taking part. Who's got the money in that race?
You know, it's a crowded field of five candidates at least. You've got Senator Josh Green, who's raising the most and spending the most. You know, he's getting a lot of support from fellow doctors. He's a physician on the Big Island. But not far behind, though, you've got his colleague, Senator Jill Tokuda, who's getting a lot of help from labor unions and others.
Have they all, there are three senators in the race, I believe, are former senators. Do they have to resign to run?
Only Senator Willis Sparrow had to resign to run, and that had to do with where he was in his term. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we've got those three senators. We've also got former Board of Education member Kim Koko Iwamoto, who filed her report late last night. So I'm just kind of looking through that one this morning. It turns out she's loaned herself about $442,000 for her campaign. So maybe expect to see some more ads from her as well.
It's odd in some ways that the Campaign Spending Commission report comes out when it does, because a lot of reporters like yourself have been waiting to get the numbers to find out who's, you know, there's a lot you can learn about the months to come, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. It's really tough because of the filing deadlines, because we're basically in the dark from January 1st to June 30th, six straight months leading all the way up to the election. I mean, I think the mail-in ballots go out in a couple weeks.
Yeah, and you're stuck all that time. You're stuck speculating, but at least now we've got some data, right?
We do, and we'll be looking into that very closely.
Thanks a lot, Nathan. That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. He joins us this morning with a look at what's on tap with the elections just around the corner.
Aloha, Catherine. Yeah, interesting listening to Nathan and Chris go through that on spending reports. You know, it's always great to have information, factual information in news. It's an unusual thing to say, but that really, when you have that granular information, it really is helpful in terms of covering campaigns and all. But of course, political season is a lot of, there are a lot of different threads to that, and now less than a month away from primaries, right? So Wayne Yoshioka is exploring not just the candidates, the issues, all of that, but a couple of more unusual angles as well. So why candidates show up at bond dances? Well, I mean, to campaign and get votes would be the clear issue, but there's a little bit more on that. And even down to the names on the ballots in alphabetical order, right? So if you are at the top of the ballot, is that an advantage or is that like a disadvantage? I mean, the classic thing in the Yellow Pages, right? If you're the alarm company, you want to be the 4A alarm company, so you're the first one that people come across.
Yeah, that's right.
But then, maybe that worked out that way for, Ariyoshi, Governor Burns, but, Governor Wahei didn't have any problems, on that score. But there are people that look at these things, actually, and analyze them, and Wayne's going to have some bits on that next week as well.
Okay. What else is on tap?
So, Oahu's the gathering place. Hawaii, in general, home for so many cultural threads and cross currents. Folks from a lot of different places, and that includes a Tokelau. Now, this sent a bunch of us scurrying for a map this morning. Kuvehi was talking about this as a piece. It's a small island country. It's actually three coral atolls with a combined land area of about 4 square miles. It's between New Zealand and Hawaii. Got a population of about 1,500. And it's also got a community here in Hawaii of immigrants and of children of immigrants. And a growing population of second-generation folks looking to strengthen ties to their ancestral home. And that's language, it's cultural immersion, and more than a little to do with ocean canoes. But Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to be our route into this community. She'll be bringing more of the sounds of that to us next week.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Yeah. And then we've been talking a lot about the homeless situation and mental health issues. We've got something coming up on that?
Yeah, a lot of strands, as we always say, to the homeless issue. But so often in Hawaii, when we talk about homelessness, a lot of coverage revolves around Honolulu, because there's so much to talk about in downtown Waikiki, but there's so much more, and it's on every island. Noe Tanigawa went to Maui to take a closer look, spending some time talking with a number of people, getting around to a number of places. She's going to be coming back to this with a number of stories, but starting out next week. The timing also, by the way, coincides with a segment that you guys are doing next week about an affordable housing project in Lahaina right on Front Street. So opportunity to get outside of Oahu a bit with a different perspective on that story.
Okay, lots to look forward to. Thanks a lot, Bill Dorman.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the 11th Honolulu Surf Film Festival now through August 3rd. Schedule at honolulumuseum.org.
Imagine a devastating tsunami strikes the island of Oahu. Ports are blocked, bridges are damaged, hospitals are overwhelmed. It's a nightmare scenario that's been playing out on Ford Island this week. Service members from 10 nations taking part in a disaster response training exercise as part of the 2018 Rim of the Pacific War Games. The conversation's Ryan Finity was on hand to observe it.
The fictional country of Griffin looks suspiciously similar to the island of Oahu, but it's been a tough week in Griffin. The island nation was hit by a powerful tsunami, damaging vital ports and airfields. Local hospitals exceeded capacity. A call goes out for help. That was the scenario given to sailors and soldiers from 10 different nations participating in RIMPAC this week. Japan was in charge of the response. International teams of engineers surveyed damaged airfields, divers worked to reopen blocked ports, and pilots evacuated sick and injured patients. U.S. Navy Reserve Captain Daryl Long is a deputy commandant for the exercise, known as Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief, or HADR. He's from the Florida Panhandle and has weathered his fair share of hurricanes, so this mission hits close to home.
That mission is really to bring initial crisis response to a location that has experienced extreme devastation from perhaps an earthquake, tsunami, and most recently that some could relate to would be the island of Puerto Rico that just recently underwent a major hurricane effort that are, quite frankly, still undergoing some disaster relief efforts.
So this is a very real-world scenario then?
Oh, absolutely. Very real-world.
What are some of the other historical instances that this type of exercise is based off of?
Another one would be the tsunami that hit Japan back in 2011 when it hit their one of their reactors, mobilized several forces. U.S. forces came to assistance with the Japanese as well. Also, the island of the Philippines in the Pacific had experienced a similar situation with a typhoon-type event and tsunami that had occurred. So several UN organizations that also came and rendered assistance and aid in trying to figure out how to really get supplies, basic necessities such as food, water, medicine, from ports out inland to those civilian populations that were most impacted by the devastation.
So what types of activities are sailors doing as a part of this training exercise? What types of actions would they take in a real-world scenario?
The immediate need would be assessing, engineering assessments of ports, airfields, infrastructure, housing, roads, bridges, waterways, clearing waterways, being able to allow for freedom of navigation in the littoral waterways so that we could get logistical supplies into a port, offload those from a cargo handling perspective, get them to a distribution center, work with the host nation to coordinate that effort with the host nation and determine the flow of those and where they would particularly go. In addition to that, you would have, in this scenario, for example, one of our task force is a general aviation battalion that's supporting search and rescue operations and medical support, medevacs. Sometimes in these events, you see hospitals that may have devastation as well. And in particular, this scenario, we have two hospitals, part of the scenario, that have received some degraded availability. So we would provide some additional medevac. For example, we've got the USNS Mercy, a hospital ship that's standing by supporting this particular exercise portion of HADR.
So tell us a little bit about the scenario. What is what's happening here in this camp?
What's happening is over the last day or so, we've discovered that there's been 3 out of 7 airfields that have been damaged. We have debris floating in the harbors. We have ports that have been damaged. We have 2 bridges that have been damaged as well that have been uncovered as part of the tsunami effect. So as part of that, it's a matter of freedom of navigation, being able to figure out the right port at the right location to help with the logistics supply, and if not, figure out an alternate location where we could bring our logistical supply vessels in. Going out to the roadways, we may have to look at an alternate container storage yard to provide some storage location for our cargo terminal companies. as part of that exercise and figuring out an appropriate distribution center, because the roads have been damaged and some of the ports. And then going from point A to point B, we had the roadways that have been damaged. It's a matter of, okay, are there any alternate routes that we may be able to figure? For example, one of our scenarios is there has been extreme obstructions of the roadways, so we have both our Navy Seabees and our Army Engineer Battalion working closely together to work to clear and grub roadways as part of the scenario, so we can create an open roadway to get those supplies where needed. In addition to that, as I mentioned previously, is the airfield damage, and we're doing those assessments to determine if they will in fact have an impact to our General Aviation Battalion that's providing support for medevac and or assistance with evacuations.
And how about here in Hawaii? We're pretty vulnerable to a tsunami or a hurricane. Is that a contingency that the Navy trains for responding to something here?
Yes, it is. In fact, as recently brought to my attention, that the Pearl Harbor here is a staging area to support such event, just as this.
And so this, what you're practicing right now, could potentially be used in real life one day here should such a disaster occur.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the beauty of this exercise, is it's really brought, you know, the Hawaiian Regional Health Center, which in fact they're going through a certification event, and we'll have a moment here soon to kind of walk you through and show you some of that hospital laydown area that they'll be preparing for a mass casualty event, and those staging areas for such event in the event that it did occur.
On the other side of the camp, a field hospital is being set up as an overflow site for local hospitals. But there is a real-life benefit to Hawaii's medical providers. Thomas Bookman is the emergency manager for all of the Army's medical facilities across the Pacific.
So we're going to do a mass casualty. We're going to move patients by air, ground, and sea operations to six islands of the Hawaiian Islands, and plus two states, Washington and Hawaii. And that piece is going to be our Federal Coordinating Center, the National Incident Management System. We're moving 30 patients to and from Washington State. What we're going to do here on Ford Island, we're going to be moving to communicate with Hawaii Emergency Healthcare Agency. We'll move patients to 27 hospitals within the state of Hawaii on those six islands.
So you're actually incorporating local government agencies into this effort?
Yes, sir. And plus, this year was the first time we ever included the CERT team, Certified Emergency Assessments Team, from each of the counties. So Ewa Beach and Kailua will also, CERT teams will be flying Army helicopters in there to extract five of their patients out.
And so what drove you to incorporate state and local offices into this training?
Yeah, the most important thing, we need to be resilient, because even our military members live in your communities. And we need to have it so that, especially the healthcare mission, if something would happen, we need to make sure that all of our civilian and military organizations, healthcare-wise, are on the same sheet of music, and we can communicate together during a disaster.
Overseeing the local healthcare response is Dr. Chris Crabtree. He's the director of Hawaii Healthcare Emergency Management and oversees the statewide emergency response for Hawaii's healthcare providers. We talked as he was setting up a 50-bed hospital in the middle of an open field.
We are actually going through a scenario in which is a catastrophic event that occurs that affects all the islands. And so healthcare is impacted, and there's all the hospitals are getting surges of patients to the point where it's becoming overwhelming, and the level of acuity of the patient is too much for some of these hospitals, so that those patients need to be transported to Oahu. And so this impact does several things. One, it allows those hospitals to practice activating their emergency operation plan, standing up their command center, working with a surge of patients and seeing how that works with their current plan, and then working with us, who we coordinate with the military, to send helicopters over to the neighbor islands to pick up those patients and bring them here to Oahu. And that's a big part of it. And so on Oahu, what we're doing is, this is a field hospital, 50 bed. And the idea is it increases capacity and capability for the healthcare sector. And so we're fielding patient actors, or rather for the scenario, patients that are gonna be walking wounded. So they're gonna come approach us, we're gonna process them through our triage, put them through our treatment tents, and then what we're going to do is we're going to send them by ambulance buses and by military helicopter to the hospitals on Oahu. Our main objective is to help support current patient services, whether it's hospitals, whether it's long-term care, home health, hospice, into the whole continuum of care, and that we can continue at least to sustain to a degree our healthcare system.
29 of Hawaii's 30 hospitals participated in this week's exercise. It was also the first time that volunteer neighborhood response teams took part, all with the dual goal of preparing the military to respond to anything and, as one official put it, make sure that Hawaii doesn't become the next Puerto Rico. From Ford Island, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
RIMPAC 2018 will run through the end of July, and we'll continue to bring you coverage of the exercise throughout the month. And next week on The Conversation, we'll take you onto the aircraft carrier, the USS Carl Vinson.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll wrap our brains around the mysteries of the universe with Stephen Hawking's classic, A Brief History of Time. It's our pick for the Summer Science Book Club. Plus, a look at a telescope messaging network that uses neutrinos to map the sky, what it can tell us about the deep universe. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
For today's Backyard Quiz, we ask listeners to tell us the year the historic Hawaii Theater was built. And if you're listening closely, you'd know we'd already given you the answer. The San Francisco newspaper headline that heralded the lavish cinema as the pride of the Pacific also came in the year of its groundbreaking, 1922. While the theater has been in operation since then, its history is not without a few rough patches. As entertainment venues and city nightlife moved away from downtown in the early 60s, attendance for the theater declined sharply for a number of years. In 1978, however, it was added to the National Register of Historic Places and was extensively renovated throughout the 90s. The Hawaii Theater is the last historic theater still in operation in all of Honolulu and has been a hub of entertainment for nearly 100 years. That's today's quiz. Nobody got that today. But if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, committed to accelerating literacy and learning for students throughout the state, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
On the next Fresh Air, our interview with Tab Hunter, a Hollywood heartthrob who later came out as gay. He died Sunday at age 86. Also, our interview with the late cartoonist John Callahan, who had paraplegia after an auto accident when he was 21, a condition he joked about in his cartoons. He's played by Joaquin Phoenix in the new movie, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Hi, I'm Annie Camilla from the band Mango Season. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Coming off this week's NATO summit, there's been lots of focus on the strained ties with our neighbors, our allies in Europe. Allies is one word that has deep meaning, particularly in the region of Normandy in France, where Allied flags still fly over the beaches, sites of some of the bloodiest battles of World War II. Members of Tu Hulahalau from Oahu were there to mark the France and Hawaii alliance and pay homage to the lives lost as Allied soldiers fought shoulder to shoulder, and where cemeteries along the coast and cliffs of Normandy serve as reminders of what was lost and gained. The sounds of bells peal from the Ermenville Church Tower throughout the day in this little town. It's where the BBC first broadcast to the world following D-Day and the liberation of France from German occupation.
To let you know that the people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation. The church bells are ringing, and the villagers are going to mass to give thanks for their freedom.
And it was at the Ermenville Cemetery, the British cemetery, that members of Halau Mele and Halau Hula Omanoa paid their respects to those who died. The townsfolk turned out too, grateful knowing that decades ago, soldiers came from so far away from our Pacific Islands to stand with them.
It was very moving to see all the group in the cemetery because, well, I know they participated too. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's very, I think it's very important here. And all the children participate, you know, in the cemetery you saw. Every 6th of June, they put a flower on each tomb, and I think it's important.
The town's mayor, Jacques Lulon, welcomed the Hawaii contingent, grateful to be included as part of the festival.
Pour le festival, je crois que c'est des îles, hein, ça doit être ça. Et ils nous ont fait le plaisir d'abord.
Christine Harkness, a longtime member of Halau Hula Omanoa, underscored the mayor's efforts to remind us of what it means to be allies.
He's always made a real effort to make veterans welcome and to push the message, you must not forget. And wherever was the right-wing vote getting high in Europe, he always insists that we must never let this happen again. So the people here are very conscious of what the war was about and what it did.
The mayor's cultural attaché, Emmanuel Jacques-Don Payette, tells us along the towns who care for the war dead of their allies, diplomacy is deeply regarded.
And it's very, very important for us. And to have this ceremony of the Hawaii ceremony, it's very important too, I think. And I have to ask the British Cemetery the authorization to come here, because here you are in England, it's not our territory. And they were very happy to have this ceremony in the cemetery.
Just out of town at the U.S. cemetery where thousands of Americans are buried, there on the wall is the name of an infantryman, Private Henry Sa'aga from Hawaii. The Halau members perform a heartfelt ole. Their presence turns heads. A French resident tells us he visits every D-Day anniversary, leaving flowers for his Hawaii friends who have ties to American soldiers buried here.
Traditionnel hawaïen pour honorer tous ceux qui reposent ici au cimetière pour apprendre plus de votre histoire.
The festival events in Normandy were a sprinkling of somber, respectful ceremonies and lighter moments, which included hula on the beach. Nothing showy, nothing splashy, just simple and sincere.
Just
and old Hawaiian custom. When we say aloha to you.
And we continue to bring you stories about the ties between Hawaii and France in the weeks to come. Tomorrow, actually, marks Bastille Day in France, another big battle in that country's history. Next week, we'll be looking at modern-day efforts by French residents to examine Hawaii's history and culture. And if you go to our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org, you can listen to today's segment again or preview previous segments, as well as look at pictures and video.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, Moyer Financial, and Kaiser Permanente.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we'll take a closer look at Hawaii's visitor industry with you, the listener, taking part.
And we'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line, record your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
And if you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find our playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's program. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our interns are Harrison Patino and Savannah Harriman Polt.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.